There's one big party going on all the time. Sometimes we get to tune into it. The rest of the time, there's love is the message.
Hello, welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor, sound systems, and counterculture. I'm Tim Lawrence, and I'm here again with Jeremy Gilbert. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hello. And so we've just got through two pretty intense episodes about the rise of DJ culture. And the truth of the matter is that the last one we recorded ended up going on for a little bit longer than planned, and we started to really think about the DJ as a new form of, or an early expression of a post-Fordist worker. And then we realized that there was just no way that we could kind of try and tackle that subject properly in the last 15 minutes of an episode that had already run for an hour or something. So we realized we wanted to set aside a bit of time to kind of give this a little bit more thought. And this is, you know, this is about a world in which new forms of work, new forms of labor, new relationships to the ideas of pleasure, of flexibility, of creativity started to come to the fore in the late 60s and accelerated during the 1970s. And this coincided with a fundamental transition in the economy from what we call a Fordist to a post-Fordist economy, or an industrial to a post-industrial economy. And so the culture as well that we're talking about, obviously a lot of it does kind of end up being rooted, emerging in these ex-industrial spaces, which is also highly, highly significant. So, yeah, we wanted to set aside some time to think about this. And we've also realized that this is going to not be something that we can deal with in one episode. We're slowly getting the hang of realizing that we just need to not try and take off, you know, massive historical chunks and try and get everything in one rushed hour, but sometimes to take things a little easier. So that's what we're doing now. And before we can really talk about post-Fordism, we do need to kind of understand a bit better what Fordism constituted. So Jeremy, this is one of your many areas of expertise. So can you tell us what do we mean when we talk about Fordism?
So Fordism is this term that was first coined by the Italian, a communist leader, philosopher, political theorist and strategist, Antonio Gramsci, in the 1930s. And Gramsci is a hugely important figure historically, but we don't need to get into detail here about Gramsci. And he coined the term in an essay called Americanism and Fordism. Actually, it's not even an essay. It's like a set of notes for a possible essay. And it wasn't really, it was read in Italian and other languages in the post-war period, but it really got taken up at the end of the 70s. And it got taken up by economists and social theorists at the end of the 70s because they were looking around and they were realizing that there were really dramatic changes going on in the whole economy, in society, in culture. And they wanted to be able to explain what it was that was changing. And they took this term Fordism from Gramsci, and the term Fordism refers to the thing that they thought at the end of the 70s was really changing. And that's when it really started to be widely used. People didn't really use the term that much before the late 70s, even though Gramsci wrote it in the 30s. But so, okay, so what is Gramsci actually talking about in the 30s? Well, he's sitting in his prison cell where he's been imprisoned by Mussolini, by the fascist administration of Mussolini's Italy, for his politics. He's sitting in his prison cell. He's still reading newspapers and books. He's trying to work out what's going on in the world. And he's arguing that one of the most striking things that's going on in the world at this moment, I think it's sort of 33, 34 he's writing, I think, is what's happening in America. This is exactly the moment of the beginning of the New Deal administration in the United States. You know, the beginning of a whole, what's still widely remembered as a whole new phase, really, in the relationship between government, workers, bosses, etc. in America, that end up influencing the way in which things develop in places like the UK in subsequent decades, with the creation of the welfare state after the war, for example. But Gramsci thinks isn't just talking about the New Deal. He isn't just talking about kind of government policy, with governments getting much more involved in managing the economy, etc. He isn't just talking about that. He calls this new form of capitalism, which he sees emerging, he calls it Fordism, because he sees it as really being born in Henry Ford's car factories in Detroit. And what's going on there is a whole number of things. So the Detroit car factories from the 1910s onwards are the first major industrial factories to use assembly lines. They're not the absolute first places ever to use assembly lines, but they're the first big, really public, really well-known factories that use assembly lines. So that you produce cars not by a kind of team of skilled craftsmen, each working on each car to produce this sort of luxury object, which is what cars had been before then. You break down the process of making a car into loads of different discrete tasks, and each person working on the assembly line just does one of those tasks all day. And this makes the production of the cars much, much cheaper. And at the same time, in order to motivate workers to take on this really boring, tedious, like, but also quite stressful form of work, you have to entice them. And so you entice them, if you're Henry Ford, by offering much higher wages than were typical for industrial workers up to that point in history. And at the same time, if you're Henry Ford, then you justify the paying of these unusually high wages to your workers. You justify it to yourself and to your fellow capitalists, many of whom are looking askance at you paying your workers these absurdly high wages. You justify it on the grounds that, well, you see, you want to pay workers quite high wages because that way they will be able to buy things from you. In fact, they will be able to buy the cars that they themselves are making.
And weren't they even offered at a reduced price or something? Or is that, am I getting
it? I think so, yeah. I'm sure they were offered a discount. Yeah. But the idea, on the cars themselves, and indeed, there was a whole long tradition of factories and factory owners sort of selling things to their own workers and paying them in kind, etc. But there was a whole different sort of theory of the relationship between, you know, the capitalist and their workers being played out here. That, you know, historically employers had just tried to get as much work as possible for as little money as possible out of their workers, right? But part of what's going on at this time, it's not just happening in Henry Ford's factories. What's going on across the advanced capitalist economy in places like Britain, other Western European countries, America, is really for capitalism to keep growing and for companies to keep growing, then they can't just do what they did in the 19th century, which is to produce luxury goods for very small small markets of affluent people and produce just basic necessities for the masses. You know, unless they can keep selling more stuff to much larger numbers of people, then the whole cycle of the accumulation of profits is going to break down. So there's this general shift towards understanding that workers aren't just kind of factory fodder to be exploited as hard as possible. They're also your consumers.
Well, there's also, if I can just, I mean, you may be getting on to say this, but I guess, you know, this is not long. It's around this time that there's the Russian Revolution. There's a fear of, you know, worker uprising spreading throughout Europe and beyond. So there was also an idea that a new compromise, a new settlement had to be made with the workforce, maybe. I'm not sure, but that's seems likely. The idea you could just exploit workers until they, you know, pay them as little as possible and they kind of die from some kind of, some disease of kind of, working in factories or poor living conditions. That wasn't sustainable by this point in the 20th century.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. That's right. And then, I mean, Ford himself is like an obsessive anti-communist and like, you know, an anti-trade unionist. He employs private security guards to beat up and in some cases probably even kill trade union organisers in his factories. But at the same time, yeah, the broader adoption, I mean, it's kind of interesting because what's going on at the moment that Gramsci is talking about in the 30s is you've got Ford, who is like, you know, a fascist, basically. He had a picture of Hitler on his desk. And
seriously? He had a picture of Hitler on his desk?
Yeah, seriously. Seriously. For some time, anyway. Like, not, I don't know for how long. Presumably not once the war started. And Hitler had one of him. Hitler was a massive admirer of Henry Ford as well. Yeah, so you've got that happening at the level of kind of the capitalist class. At the level of government, you've got the New Deal administration led by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, etc. And they're quite self-consciously a left-wing, like progressive project. And they are quite self-consciously trying to bring in a whole set of political and economic measures which will strengthen workers kind of collectively and individually and will weaken capitalists. And that's partly, indeed, it's partly because they these people are not revolutionaries, they're not communists. They see, and they are able to persuade quite large sections of the kind of middle classes and even some sections of the capitalist classes in America. They're able to persuade them that indeed, as you say, look, it's either this or revolution. Either we're going to have to make concessions. We're going to have to raise wages, let people organize in trade unions, offer people a kind of expanding range of opportunities in education, et cetera, and especially in just an expanded opportunity to be consumers. Then there's going to be revolution. Look what's happened in Russia. Look what's happening in other places. So, all that is definitely part of it. But I think you're making a sort of bigger point in a way, which is that this isn't just like Henry Ford's cunning plan. It's not just the cunning plan being executed by the ideologues and organizers of the new capitalism. It is also what's happening in the world. Is there's this growing pressure from kind of organized workers, politically organized and organizing trade unions, that capitalists are kind of being forced to respond to. And that is going to be a theme for us in thinking about Fordism and post-Fordism, that the question of, well, is it capitalists who just do this stuff because they're clever and they're thinking of new ways to make money and they're competing with other capitalists? Or is it actually the case that normally capitalists are having to respond to the kind of problems posed for them by high levels of worker organization? And I think most of the time it's a bit of both. I mean, most of the time both those things are happening at the same time. And I think that's definitely the case here. I mean, the other part of this process is of course the Fordist factory and the Fordist model itself, sort of inadvertently, and this isn't part of Ford's plan, but it creates conditions for workers to become much better organized than they ever have done. So Gramsci writes this essay, and it's really prescient. Gramsci thinks that, unlike most sort of social critics of the time, he thinks that it's going to be good from a left-wing perspective to have people standing around on assembly lines, like working in these factories. Because he says, look, A, these people are no longer having to invest any kind of emotional or intellectual energy in their work. They're almost just like being treated like robots, but their minds are still going to be free. So they've got intellectual energy and attention. They've got headspace free to think about organizing all day. And they're in these massive factories where they all have to work to this rigid time schedule. So they're not working like weird shifts like people in a 19th century textile mill. In the Fordist factory, everybody turns up at 9, everybody clocks off at 5. So it's actually really easy for them to form unions and to organize with each other and to make demands. And also, the logic, the policy of the New Deal administration in America, and in some ways the logic of Fordism as an economic practice, was to lead to full employment. And of course, once you've got full employment, then trade unions are in a much more powerful position to bargain. Of course, that would always be one of the problems. I mean, one of the problems from a capitalist perspective was always going to be, well, okay, if you pay workers too much and you create too many jobs for them, and you're going to create full employment. And historically, one of the main tools in the kind of armory of capitalists in defending their own interest against workers was the threat of unemployment. But that will sort of come later, I think, as an issue.
Yeah, I think we should have a record. So have you got one that you think will work well at this particular point in the program?
Yeah, well, absolute classic of rhythm and blues, arguably the classic of rhythm and blues would be Ike Turner, 1951, Rocket 88. And it, which is a song of celebrating, owning a cool, fast car. So this is really kind of exemplary, and of course this is exemplary of the way in which the way in which car ownership by the early 50s has become. I mean, the cars have become already like completely central to the capitalist economy. Like, the car industry is widely understood as the driving force of the whole sort of capitalist economy. But also, what is it that car ownership kind of holds out the promise of? It holds out the promise of not just surviving like previous generations of workers, but having a degree of personal freedom, having mobility. Like, it's a kind of personal empowerment. So I think it really is it's really kind of interesting. And it's interesting, of course, that there were lots of black workers in Ford's factories. It's often pointed out that the New Deal settlement, as it's called, you know, had a strongly racist component, that basically the way in which Roosevelt persuaded the Southern Democrats to support it was just by ignoring demands for desegregation, which were already, you know, part of the political discourse in places like New York. But at the same time, it's also true that full employment brought workers into the cities. And one of the reasons why, you know, the Great Migration was really still taking place, black workers were still moving from the South into the cities like Chicago and Detroit and New York, was because the industrial economy, especially at this moment, the early 50s, sort of peak moment, the industrial economy is sucking in workers and they're a job.
V8 motor and this smart and designed black convertible top and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow!
I think the point that one of the things to come out of this, and you kind of gestured to it already, is that, you know, there is something, you know, the workers get kind of quite a lot in return through the Fordist settlement: structure, security, good wages, increasing access to material goods. But there is something about the whole system that gets to be quite, it's very structured, it's very hierarchical. And it tends to kind of reinforce sort of social practices as well as work practices that are kind of already being established as being relatively conservative. So maybe this song kind of fits, you know, the culture around cars is partly doing that. It's not like cars are sort of challenging sorts of power relations in society. My guess is that cars are possibly doing the opposite, but maybe that's, I don't know. Do you know about this stuff?
Well, Paul Gilroy has a good essay in his little book, Darker Than Blue, about the place of the car, the sort of, you know, the sort of black, especially the African-American kind of musical imaginary. And Paul is coming from a perspective which indeed is very critical of sort of car culture and its historical implications. So and he thinks it, you know, it's a kind of, you know, basically a regressive feature that persists right through into hip-hop, for example, and, you know, it's there in contemporary grime, you know, in the obsession with the car as a status symbol and as the status symbol. And obviously, you know, there are ecological and social reasons why that's a bad idea. I mean, I think that's all true, but I don't think you can ignore that. You know, especially for black people whose mobility was historically really constricted, especially, you know, people who were coming up from the kind of rural segregated South into the northern industrial areas, even people who are still living in the South. And the fact that the car gave you mobility, like, was a real sort of experience of a certain kind of freedom as well.
Of course, but I just wonder, I mean, if I don't know the figures on this, but I'd be interested to see, you know, the ownership of cars broken down according to race as well as gender.
Yeah, sure.
And I would be quite surprised if there's not a huge differential between, you know, white ownership and black ownership. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Well, I would say this is the theme for us. I think, you know, an interesting theme to take forward is this sense that there's a tension between certain different aspects of Fordist culture already. There's a tension between a way of making cars, which is about bringing everyone together in these big factories and coordinating their activity en masse and mass producing cars. So everybody gets an identical car. I mean, Henry Ford famously, when he was asked, like, you're going to make your Model T cars in any other color, he famously says, you can have any color you like as long as it's black. On the other hand, you know, Fordism is also based upon selling people individual products, which they consume individually, in which the car is a kind of also the ultimate expression of, you know, it's this mass produced object, but it's going to give you personal freedom and it's going to sort of separate you from your wherever you, the places that you're leaving. And all these kind of, all these rock and roll and R&B songs about cars, they celebrate this idea of the open road. And then, you know, the Beatniks, you know, Jack Kerouac with his novel On the Road, it's this celebration of the idea of the road trip, the car, you know, the American road as this kind of expression of a kind of highly individualized notion of freedom. And both those things are present in that culture in the 50s, and they're both present in the sort of music of the 50s, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's the, you know, it's complex, right? So there's that, and then there's also cars as a, you know, way of displacing public transport, for example. I think this became kind of the strategy of in California or in, maybe in Los Angeles rather than California.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
the development, it was the rise of the car industry that kind of, you know, arranged for, you know, public transport to not be developed so that it could increase its market share.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's a really good
point. There's absolutely the freedom for adventure, which is, you know, plays into this kind of the deep, you know, plays deep into the American psyche of, you know, pioneer culture. But then there's also about, it's also about individualism, private, you know, valuing your privacy, being able to kind of, you know, being autonomous in terms of your movement. So, you know, therefore the car enables people to kind of, you know, especially maybe a rising manager class to, you know, travel from the suburbs to the center of a city. That's how the cars are used, basically. And then, you know, one in 100,000 or one in 500,000 might go off on a kind of, you know, exciting road trip of discovery. But this links nicely anyway, of course, to, you know, one of Ford's most famous employees, Berry Gordy, who worked in one of Ford's factories in Detroit and went on to structure Motown very specifically on his experience of working in one of Ford's factories. So there was this whole breakdown of labor within Motown. So each, like, just as the process of making a car had several stages, so Berry Gordy kind of understood that the recording of a record did as well. So you'd have teams of songwriters, teams of musicians, teams of kind of, you know, vocalists and kind of, you know, lead artists, all the various stages of production and post-production and marketing would kind of operate as if it was kind of an, you know, this kind of elongated assembly line of a Ford factory. And the idea was to create a recognizable product where, you know, although there would be lots of records, of course, coming out, they could be, there was a kind of identifiable sound, branded sound, I guess you could say. There was a, you know, there was, it was a paternalistic environment with Berry Gordy kind of, you know, very much in control, offering, you know, enticements and certain rewards to the musicians who are participating in this project. But I guess also, in a sense, making sure that what they were primarily was Motown artists. You know, that was kind of, you know, so there was lots of groups were emerging, but they were all kind of very much kind of tied into this kind of this Motown production line. And of course, you know, interestingly, Berry Gordy was also, he wanted to sell music, right? That was one of his kind of his main aims. So part of it was to kind of, you know, some people might say dilute, modify, dampen down the kind of the blackness of R&B so that it kind of, you know, there was less emphasis on the things that kind of might scare off white listeners, because indeed it was white listeners who had the most money to spend on music. So the sound of the music reduced the amount of kind of bass, for example, that was going into those records. We know that the artists were kind of, you know, made, you know, dressed up in quite glamorous outfits to make them kind of seem non-threatening. And, you know, maybe most interesting of all is that Berry Gordy thought that the most important way of selling his music was going to be through cars, people listening to music while driving their car. Therefore, it needed to sound good on radio, car radio. This is in the age before reinforced bass starts taking over car radios. So it made sense for Berry Gordy to also kind of fine-tune to develop a kind of a production aesthetic where there was less emphasis on bass, because even if there had been emphasis on bass, you wouldn't hear it in the car. So it's a kind of, everything comes together here, really, you know, including, you know, four practices, a rising black middle class, as you've also identified, the car as a key part of the economy and increasingly a key part of the way that music is listening to. And, you know, arguably, you know, one of the, if not the most influential labels to emerge during the 1960s.
So the actual name Motown is from the fact that Motown at the time was a nickname, one of the nicknames for Detroit, and it's just a contraction of Motortown and
exactly.
You know, the Motor City. Detroit was named because it was named, you know, and it got that name from the Ford plants being there and it being the center of the world car industry. And Gordy was absolutely explicit that he about that connection. I mean, there's photographs of Motown artists in the Ford factories. He was completely explicit about being inspired by the Ford model. And if he'd been aware of the term Fordism, he would have just said, "I'm a Fordist," you know. So there's no question. And yeah, no, I think your analysis is great there. It's really all of the sort of ambivalence of Fordist culture in a way. The fact that it does succeed, I mean, in the 50s in producing this mass culture that does get an awful lot of buy-in from awful lots of people, you know, whether you're talking about cinema or sport. You know, in Britain, the late 50s is the peak era of people going to football matches, for example. You know, this is the golden era of the cinema in terms of everybody going to see the same films at the weekend. And, you know, it does produce this sort of mass culture. And at its best, that produces something like the best of Motown, which is like incredibly listenable music, which can appeal to a huge range of audiences. But on the other hand, it does so at the expense of, you know, lots of, you know, more fine-grained qualities in whatever culture or product you're talking about, including music.
Okay, so let's, we've got a record lined up that kind of, you know, expresses this moment very nicely. I think it's Berry Gordy's first production, The Miracles, Got a Job. So, you know, what could be more perfect? A 1958 record, and it's just about getting work. It's about the labor market, and the importance of work. And it's kind of the lyrics are kind of, you know, it's about work not always being particularly pleasurable. But, you know, work is central to the economy. And Berry Gordy, who would go on to, as we've just been discussing, kind of form Tamla and then Motown, to produce his first record on a topic that coincides with Fordism.
Walked all day till my feet were tired. I was low, I just couldn't get hired. Saw a sign in a grocery store. Help is light, and we need some more.
I got a job.
Enjoying the show? If you have the means, please consider becoming a supporter on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes. You can become a supporter from as little as £3 per month. Thanks, and back to the show.
Love is, love is, love is the message.
One of the things that kind of characterizes Motown, you know, in its early years, riding right through to its peak, is the extent to which there's a sense of a group identity, maybe even a corporate identity ultimately. And we get this in the way that the groups are formed and their names. So we have, you know, the Jackson Five, we have Diana Ross and the Supremes, we have Martha and the Vandellas. There are others as well, of course. It seems that everything is about the group rather than a single individual. How do you see this as like fitting into this kind of Fordist moment?
Yeah, well, this is really interesting because Fordism arguably, as a historical epoch, like the epoch of Fordism is the great epoch of the collective. So one thing we haven't really mentioned yet is that one way of understanding Fordism is it's the form of industrial society that emerges really after what historians call the Second Industrial Revolution. So it's all the technological innovations of the late 1930s, 20th century. So it's railways, planes, cars, but cinema, radio, etc. And most of those things, they create a kind of unique historical window in which, for example, governments are able to really control things centrally in a way that they couldn't really control populations or flows of goods and people as effectively before or after, with all kinds of good and bad consequences. But that is another reason why you get this kind of infrastructure of kind of railways allowing people to kind of travel from one place to another, according to in a very regulated way. Above all, you get the media, which is all this kind of centrally broadcast-based media. You know, cinema, the cinema is all, you know, cinema is a kind of global industry, but it's all distributed from Hollywood. You know, broadcast media like radio and later television, they're about one studio sending out the signal to the rest of the country. But yeah, this is the golden age of mass publishing as well, actually. Publishers, you know, publishing magazines and books, you know, for mass audiences. So yeah, there is this real sense of people feeling like they're belonging to these great large communities. You know, they're working together in factories, or if they're women, they're living very kind of, you know, this is also the golden age of the ideal of the housewife, even though in fact more women were going out to work than had done in previous decades. And there was this idea that everybody was living quite a similar kind of life, you know. And so, in all these different ways, in both good and bad ways, it was sort of the era of the collective. You know, it's also the era of the height of the power of, you know, the Soviet Union and communism, and, you know, for similar reasons, arguably. And that that can be really inspiring, you know, and you just have to hear the sort of fantastic harmonies of sort of groups like the Supremes to hear how this incredibly collective kind of music can be really affecting and really kind of moving. But it also could be about the promotion of certain kinds of conformism. And again, this was something that one reason why when people went back and read that Gramsci essay in the 70s, this essay he wrote in the 30s, they were so impressed by it. Because even in the 30s, like Gramsci is saying, well, one of the things about this Fordism is this particular way of organizing industrial capitalism is it's going to encourage a really strict division of labor, as we say, really strict separation between genders. So it's going to really encourage the idea that women should stay at home and be housewives and men should go out to work. And Gramsci's explanation of that is just that, well, you know, the actual assembly line work is physically really demanding. And that, you know, if you're going to have a man working on a Ford assembly line and not, and then having, you know, have go home in the evening and not kind of go crazy, he's got to have somebody looking after him full time. I mean, it's a bit of a complicated argument. It doesn't work in all instances, because also in various bits of light manufacturing, there were loads of women working on assembly lines. So it sort of works, sort of doesn't work, but as an explanation. But even if it might have seemed tendentious when he said it, he's right that what's happened in the 50s is that the culture that we now associate with Fordism, the culture of mass manufacturing, the culture of sort of post-war mass culture and the welfare state, it was all based on this really strict kind of gender division of labor and a very strict and conformist ideas about what men should be like, what women should be like, and the presumption of heterosexuality, the presumption of marriage as early as possible being the desirable life goal for everybody. And you hear that in a lot of the music. I mean, especially the music made by women, kind of Motown and attendant forms of pop and soul, is that until the end of this, well, until sort of 67, 68, although it's kind of aesthetically, it's incredibly powerful. Like the lyrics are nearly always about, you know, positioning women in this very passive role and aspiring, you know, to marriage, basically. An example I always play to students to kind of illustrate that is Martha and the Vandellas, Third Finger Left Hand, which is the B-side to Jimmy Mac, a much more famous single. You know, Martha and the Vandellas are better known for songs like Dancing in the Street. You know, they're often, you know, quite a kind of sort of celebratory, and even, you know, songs like Jimmy Mac, even slightly kind of edgy band. But even in 1967, they're still putting out a record like this, which is just a kind of soppy celebration of marriage. I think it indicates how entrenched those ideas were in the culture of Motown.
Music, dance, sound systems, counterculture. This is Love is the Message.
So we obviously want to kind of think about this in relation not only to kind of the way that labels are organized, but the way that musicians kind of, are able to seek out employment, which is more varied and doesn't just follow this kind of one model that Berry Gordy was instituting in Detroit, of course. So I'm just trying to kind of think of this a little bit off the top of my head, but I guess there is, you know, today we think of, you know, musicians as often being kind of freelancers, effectively part of what we call the gig economy. I suppose going back in history to this, you know, this kind of Fordist period, and particularly in the post-war era, there are a number of musicians who just get jobs right, and they are often unionized. Many musicians today don't bother to kind of join a union, don't see that as being something that's kind of relevant to them. But there were active musicians unions. I would imagine that everyone who would kind of be playing in an orchestra, for example, would be signed up to a union. We could also kind of, I mean, mention in passing that the very idea of the orchestra, according to Jacques Attali, grew out of kind of the rise of, you know, capitalist culture, the rise of the bourgeoisie, and that the orchestra itself was structured on kind of the industrial kind of factory, with kind of a large workforce at the bottom of the period and a chief executive director figure, owner at the very top of that period. There is this sort of history throughout the 19th and, you know, opening decades and a bit beyond of the 20th century, where musicians do have the status of kind of workers. They get jobs that are effectively 9-to-5 jobs, and they work for, you know, they work as session musicians in recording studios, or they work for orchestras. But there is this other side in which there is, you know, which kind of, you know, I guess most famously might kind of, you know, center around the bebop musicians of just after the, you know, whether it's the very late 1940s and the early 1950s, who have a very different sense of how they exist within, you know, within work, if you like. And it's independent. It's not regulated. It's all about creativity. And in fact, the idea of actually being paid is kind of the last thing that's supposedly on their minds. And that's kind of relegated, with art always foregrounded as the kind of most important element. So, you know, this is not really about post-Fordism specifically, but perhaps it gives us an early way into thinking about the way in which, you know, musicians would soon be at the forefront of workers who want to seek more flexibility, more freedom, and more the ability to live more creative lives, even if this leads them to kind of not have some of the financial and, you know, life securities that come with a regular kind of job, whether that be for an orchestra in a recording studio or wherever it might be. So where do you see musicians kind of existing within this kind of, you know, the shift from a Fordist to a post-Fordist culture?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there was a sort of Fordization even of musicians' employment for some musicians. I think it was always pretty tenuous compared to people working in factories or what have you. There were never that many jobs that were kind of full-time secure jobs with benefits for musicians. But there was such a thing as a union rate, for example. There were union benefits, which is really important. But also, of course, it's also at the level of production, at the level of the companies. You know, I think talking about jazz is a really good example, because as we'll see when we talk about post-Fordism next time, post-Fordism comes to be associated with the idea of like much smaller companies doing much more niche products, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, fashion or music or film or whatever. But even in the 50s, like jazz, especially the kind of more experimental end of jazz, is largely distributed, you know, produced and distributed by small niche companies who were conscious of having a kind of specialist audience. And indeed, as you said, like musicians themselves, especially the musicians playing on those kind of labels, recording for those kind of labels, would understood themselves as wanting, as being very much outside the 9-to-5 world. In fact, that's why they become these kind of figures of fascination for the beatniks, for example, in the late 50s. They become the figure of the person who is not kind of contained by the structures of Fordist society. I mean, the 50s up to, say, the first half of the 60s is usually thought of, say, the mid-40s to the mid-60s, including kind of bebop and the kind of cool jazz and hard bop and modal jazz. They're usually thought of as being the periods which in which jazz as a kind of controlled, relatively controlled, but also very kind of experimental form of improvisation, you know, improvisational music really, really develops. And it's obviously, in some sense, it's a kind of counterpoint to the predictability and the kind of controlled and regimented nature of Fordist life, I think. I think that's partly why it appeals. Of course, it might be that it's only in a society that has things like full employment and a welfare state that you can have a professional class of musicians who are doing something as kind of wild as jazz and actually making a living out of it. It might be that you need that infrastructure in order for that to actually be a viable career for anybody. You know, it becomes almost impossible to make a career as a jazz musician and actually pay the rent, like really after the end of the 60s, like unless you're a massive star or unless you have a job at a university or something.
Without music, life would be a mistake.
I guess one of the one early reaction, and maybe it's even a pre-reaction, but it is a reaction to kind of industrialization more generally, if not specifically Fordism, is kind of the rise of Bohemia, which also I haven't really thought this through what the relationship between Bohemia and post-Fordism might be, but it enables us to kind of go back to a much an earlier historical moment and think about the ways in which people were also kind of wanting to reject the mundane aspects of kind of consumerism, of, you know, rigid life patterns, of the dullness of the kind of, you know, the different stages of life that everyone is expected to go to, and, you know, the suppression of, you know, creativity and adventure, if you like. So there are, you know, this goes back, you know, goes back a long way. So I guess, you know, the bebop is kind of, in a way, it's not straightforwardly maybe about post-Fordism, but it is kind of bohemian. It is kind of drawing on that legacy. And it does point that it does, they, you know, these, as you say, quite rightly, these musicians and this moment does become kind of, you know, very influential for the rise of the counterculture that we've sort of been thinking quite a lot about so far.
All right, we could have a track from Lenny Tristano's album, his first self-titled album, I think from 55. Lenny Tristano's is a jazz pianist, and it's just, well, there's no reason for choosing Tristano except his name came into my head, and you know, he's less obvious than some others, but this is from the mid-50s, and yeah, he was a really popular collaborator, you know, with lots of other jazz musicians, and he's playing we could have the version of these Foolish Things from his album, you know, his kind of interpretation of a jazz standard, and that's a pretty typical expression of the way in which jazz is kind of exploring forms of melodic improvisation at the time. So, although jazz culture in the 50s, it's associated, as Tim said, with bohemianism. It's associated with a fairly kind of abstract desire for freedom from routine. But in more concrete ways, I mean, by the late 50s or early 60s, you can really see that various social constituencies who feel particularly constrained by Fordism are pushing against those constraints. So, I mean, I always say that, for example, the literature of this period is really kind of characterized by a strong sense of women's dissatisfaction with the Fordist settlement, with the expectation that they should be housewives. And this is also the period of the rise of the civil rights movement. You know, the fact that this highly conformist culture, which is dominated by white people, which is built on a kind of historic, you know, settlement in America in particular, which accepted segregation, even though it was clearly unjust and unconstitutional. This is all kind of building up at this time, and also just generally sort of young people are pushing against the sort of culture of deference and the culture of conformism which characterized the post-war culture. So you can even think of a song, I mean, maybe we'll play it, maybe we won't, because everybody knows it. You think of a song like Blue Suede Shoes, you know, originally Carl Perkins' song, which is just a song celebrating having a fashionable and distinctive item of clothing. You know, it becomes a sort of anthem because consumer culture is becoming not just sort of mass culture, not just a place where you signify the fact that you belong to this great imaginary community of the nation. It's also where you express your distinctiveness or your belonging to smaller, more specific groups of people like rock and roll fans. And so by the early 60s, I think there's a sort of growing sense that all this is going to have to change. So again, by 1964, which I think is a really sort of pivotal moment, at least in music, you've got, you know, two really famous anthems that both celebrate the idea of change in a pretty sort of contentless way. So early in 64, you get the release of Sam Cooke's Change Is Gonna Come, kind of classic reworking of a sort of a, you know, of a kind of tune and structure that would have come from the kind of spiritual tradition, but it's turned into a kind of general, a general call for an assertion of the need for, you know, social change. And then probably, you know, if you want an example of a kind of set of a lyric which manages to not say anything at all while sounding like it's incredibly kind of important, then like Bob Dylan's Times They Are A-Changing, this is from the same year, is also a really good example.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving.
And another track, a track that always sort of fascinates me, like from this moment, is the Shangri-Las, I Can Never Go Home Anymore.
You wake up every morning, go to school every day, spend your nights on the corner, just passing time away. Your life is so lonely, like a child without a toy. Then a miracle, a boy. And that's called glad.
The Shangri-Las, this girl group, they're better known for the leader of the pack and Give Him a Great Big Kiss, these kind of songs. I mean, they're a white group from New Jersey, and they're basically doing a sort of pop pastiche of the Motown girl group. And it's a sort of pastiche, but this song is this kind of incredible song. It's almost a sort of spoken word, and it's about this girl having a problematic relationship with her mother because of her infatuation with a boy. And it's kind of offering advice to the presumed female audience, listenership, not to allow their relationship and their sense of female solidarity, like with their mothers, to be damaged by, you know, relationships with men. And it's really, for me, it's a really fascinating kind of indicator of the ways in which sort of dissatisfaction with the sort of romantic heterosexual narrative is becoming more and more a normal theme in music. But then, of course, then that really obviously starts to sort of explode at the end of the 60s. You've got Aretha, you know, doing her famous recording of Otis Redding's Respect, which is obviously marked a kind of significant turning point in that history. And then, I mean, there's all kinds of things happening by the end of the 60s, which are making it clear that, you know, the period of Fordism and everything that it brought with it is sort of coming to an end, isn't it?
I mean, I guess I think one of the things that, you know, absolutely, and one of the things that's worth thinking about is, you know, why do people want change? Well, you know, we've gone over that. You've just gone over some of this now. We've gone over it before. There's racial inequality, there's gender inequality, there's inequality between different, you know, people of different sexualities. So there's a lot that's problematic and needs to be shaken up within this kind of Fordist settlement, if you like. It was, you know, became a bit too comfortable with its own kind of assumptions of, you know, structures and hierarchies and who would be in control of all these situations. I think another thing that's worth kind of mentioning before we look at the breakup or begin to think about the breakup of the Fordist settlement, it's worth noting just how successful it was. There was this kind of, you know, there was a very, you know, there was a sustained period of pretty rapid economic growth from the post-war era right through to the end of the 1960s. And in a sense, it was this kind of wealth that kind of in part also enabled some of the beneficiaries of Fordism to become disillusioned with it, you know, because their aspiration, their goal was to no longer like want to kind of, you know, flee precarity or poverty in order to get a secure job, which could give them the dream of a home and a backyard and a car and with a radio and, you know, the basis to build a family and all the rest of it, a heterosexual family. The model had been so successful that people felt that they kind of wanted to move beyond it effectively, that it wasn't there was basically this overriding sensation emerged. Even with people who do, you know, let's say even with, you know, the, you know, white guys who were the beneficiaries of this settlement, who began to think that there was, you know, there was more to life than kind of, you know, meeting someone of the opposite sex, having a family, having a good income, having a car and maybe going on a holiday for a couple of weeks a year. There was a, you know, a desire for working lives to become fulfilling, for working, for people's everyday lives to become more flexible, more meaningful. So this all tied in to the wider movements for social change that we've talked about that Fordism didn't kind of satisfy. But there was a general, you know, there was also a general reaction against the idea of rigid structures and hierarchies. So we do see this coming through partly in Motown, even, I think. With the breakup of some of these groups that had become, that were, you know, in which kind of, you know, the stars within these groups had been somewhat submerged to the group identity and that group identity to the label identity of Motown. But as the 1960s progressed, there was this kind of, you know, move. And then through the 1970s, there would be a move for, you know, stars such as Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, among two of the most prominent, of course, to want to basically have solo careers. So is this something you see as being expressive of the kind of this shift from a kind of the Fordist structures to the destructuring of post-Fordism?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you've summed it up perfectly, really. You made me realise we hadn't quite explained why we use this term settlement to talk about Fordism. I mean, the idea of the Fordist settlement is the idea that, well, really, especially after World War II, there's a sort of deal struck between workers, capitalists, and government. And the deal goes like this: all right, we're not going to have full revolution like we were threatening in the 20s and 30s and like happened in the Soviet bloc. We're not going to have that. But in return for not having revolution, and in fact, the citizenry of places like Britain and America accepting the Cold War and everything that goes with it, in return for that, what those populations are going to get is a bigger increase in wealth, a bigger increase in a share of the wealth accorded to working people than has ever happened in history. The most significant narrowing of the gap between rich and poor since the aftermath of the Black Death. Like literally for centuries. It's basically the only one, to be honest. There's two significant periods in history that I know of, at least if you're talking about a European and American history, when the gap between the rich and the poor really shrinks. And that is the aftermath of the Black Death, when a third of the population has been killed by the Black Death, and there's a huge shortage of labour, and there's loads of spare land, people could just wander off and start farms and stuff. There's that, and there's this period. There's the Fordist period. But along with that, as part of the deal, you also get this very, people have to accept this very conformist culture. And you have to accept a situation in which the real winners are the male heads of families amongst both the working classes and the kind of professional classes. They're the real winners. They're the people whose lives have been completely transformed and are like the kings of their little castles at home now, you know, with their cars, indeed, you know, and everything else. And then everyone else increasingly like pushes against this settlement. But yeah, you're completely right. I mean, you also get as a product of this, and it, you know, it's always crucial to say, I always say to students about this, look, we're living in an epoch now, like, and really since the 80s, when the norm in like movies, for example, is to look back on the 50s as this slightly horrible time, this time of repression, of racism, of homophobia, of sexism, paranoia, misogyny, yeah, paranoia. And all that is true. It's also true that it's the period when the lives which working people had dreamed of and struggled for literally 150 years were finally achieved, were finally made possible. The first time in history, since like hunter-gatherer times that we know of, that most people weren't worried about how they were going to eat 12 months from now at any given time. It's really kind of extraordinary achievement. And then, of course, but then what is the consequence of that? As you say, one of the consequences of that is that the baby boomer generation are the only generation in history, really, who've grown up in a context like that. And how do many of them react? They react by saying, okay, great, we've fixed all these problems, let's fix all the others. And let's, you know, we got rid of this much hierarchy, repression and inequality, let's get rid of all of it, you know, let's abolish it all. And let's combine, you know, the fruits of a highly technological industrial society, you know, and all of the things that collective action and social and state action can make possible, let's combine them with, you know, the expanding our capacities for personal freedom as well. And that is really the sort of basis of the kind of social and cultural eruption of the 60s.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and so what, you know, from my understanding, but again, I think you know more about this than I do, that somehow many of these kind of, these, this kind of wide intertwined or interconnected social rebellion was partly predicated on the wealth that had been generated in the post-war.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the answer to the question is, well, I mean, one way of looking at this is, again, I always say to students, you know, people like you and me, I know you like to say I'm the expert on this, but you're a pretty, by most standards, you're an expert on this as well. We have all these kind of theories of ideology, these theories of like, why do people accept exploitation, oppression, inequality? Why doesn't everyone at any point in history, and especially today, just, you know, make a revolution and establish, you know, a socialist utopia? Why don't they? And we've got all these great explanations, which are really important. But the simplest answer to the question is always, look, if you're living in a society where raising your children and feeding your children is difficult but achievable, you're not going to do revolution because you're going to be too busy raising and feeding your children. And you're going to do it because it's possible and that's your first priority in life and it's achievable. But we know from historical examples that if it becomes completely impossible to feed your children, you're going to get a revolution. But we also know from the experience of the 60s, and that this was the first time, this was like a big experiment in a way, that if it becomes too easy to raise and feed your children, you're going to come very close to revolution. Because also, once it becomes too easy for people to do it, people will say, well, you know, fuck all this shit. They'll say that's a wage labour and capitalism, and they'll try to overthrow it, which is sort of what happens with 1968 and the wave of the wave of radical militancy, which also includes a wave of radical militancy amongst young workers in industry in the 60s and 70s. You get, you know, demands for workers' control of industry becoming a kind of key feature of radical trade unionism in places like Britain. So yeah, but of course you're absolutely right. I mean, that is all dependent upon people feeling they have the kind of the imaginative scope and the energy and just the free time to try to organize for that kind of thing, and also to experiment with all kinds of lifestyle experiments that make up the other elements of the counterculture. You know, you've got time to kind of, you know, mess around with LSD and take up meditation and listen to weird kinds of music your parents wouldn't even recognize as music. You've got time to do all that because, you know, the period from sort of, you know, especially from the early 60s to the end of the 70s is a period when real wages are at a kind of historic peak. Maybe you'd have to include the 50s there as well.
I guess there, just to kind of close, you know, to kind of wrap things up a little bit, there are, I mean, there's lots of different ways that we, that kind of music culture responds to the slow decline in industrial culture that begins in, I guess we could say, probably the late 1960s, maybe the early 1970s. And we're going to go on to explore these, and we've already sort of looked into this a little bit with the emergence of the DJ as a new form of flexible, creative, and also democratic, or kind of, to a certain extent, we might say, sort of anti-hierarchical kind of labor. But one thing we kind of could touch on quickly before we sort of wrap things up, and then we might have time for one more as well, is to just think about some of the anxiety or the anger or the frustration that starts to emerge even in the late 60s as a result of the beginnings of industrial decline. The idea that, you know, this secure future that was once guaranteed is no longer going to be available. So, you know, we have, as you well know, you know, the earliest strains of proto-punk kind of emerge, including in Detroit, of course, with the Stooges, and also, you know, running in parallel in Birmingham, which is the center of the motor industry in the United Kingdom, the rise of kind of the early strains of metal, heavy metal bands like Black Sabbath.
It's very hard to find many prior examples of music as a vehicle for the expression of anger. It's probably a whole thing for us to come back and do a whole show about sometime. But even kind of revolutionary music, like before this, isn't usually expressing anger. It's expressing the sort of joy of militancy. It's encouraging people to fight. But what you get, and with the blues, is about this kind of, you know, the blues is about kind of regret and sadness. And then what you get in the late 60s is, in, as you said, is these bands like Sabbath, Zeppelin, the Stooges, in a slightly different way, the MC5, also from Detroit. They're using kind of blues, but they're ramping it up, and they're bringing this kind of macho energy to it in order to express anger. And I think it's partly what happens when you sort of subtract the utopian optimism from acid rock, from the kind of noisy matrix of acid rock. What you're left with instead is this kind of angst-fueled music. And it's really striking that indeed, within a couple of years of unemployment in the car industry starting to tick upwards in Britain and America for the first time since the war, you get that this is the response, and the response is coming from precisely those places. And it's about young men, of working class young men who are sensing, sort of in some cases, I think just sort of intuitively, that the post-war promise that was, you know, offered to their fathers of being, you know, the king in your little castle was being withdrawn. That wasn't going to be available to them in the same way. And they're angry. They're furious. They're absolutely enraged. If we think of this as a sort of abstract operation, you know, metal, heavy rock is what happens when you have acid rock and then you subtract the kind of optimism from it. There's a similar kind of operation, I think, goes on within soul music. They're the kind of all of the elements that we think of as expressing the utopian, optimistic, forward-looking features of soul music, the strings, the gospel elements, are kind of subtracted from it. And what is left is a music which is just about kind of dancing here now, you know, and the pleasures of the body, the pleasure of, you know, what various critics have talked about as the kind of, the, you know, the pleasures of presence and imminence. And this is what you get really with the music of James Brown, the kind of the beginning of funk.
There's something kind of, I think there's one of the things that comes out of all these records or groups or developments that we're talking about, as a sense in which they kind of capture something about the machine, I think, you know, whether it's the kind of, it's the, you know, the emphasis on, you know, what maybe, for want of a better term, we could call the sort of repetitive kind of noise structure of metal and punk, which is, you know, almost kind of capturing machines kind of, you know, cranking around and, you know, grinding against each other as a kind of raw energy. Obviously a masculine energy. And, you know, James Brown's funk, you know, is kind of operating in a kind of similar way. You know, there's clearly something machinic about this. And there's a pleasure in the machine. It's famous how, you know, James Brown would kind of organize and discipline his band as if it was kind of, you know, he was running a kind of military operation. for running an industrial operation is not altogether different, really. I mean, it's all about people fulfilling certain roles and disciplines and being and kind of fulfilling the demands of the kind of, you know, in this case, the band leader. And what's really compelling about Sex Machine is the way that, you know, it takes the machine and it puts it towards sort of bodily pleasure, effectively. It's in this kind of moment, in this situation of repetition, in this case, a form of musical repetition, that we can get a kind of forms of pleasure and release and catharsis. And indeed, it's also, you know, this idea of, you know, the machine kind of, you know, operating kind of, you know, with the purpose of kind of, of the idea of sexual pleasure as well. So, I mean, this is something you've also thought about, I know, so.
Yeah, well, it was your idea to play Sex Machine. It's a brilliant idea, now I think about it. It's your idea, because indeed, Gramsci is partly, when he's writing about Fordism, he famously says Fordism produces a new kind of man. And one of the features of the new kind of man is its sexual repression, is it has to be sexually controlled. He talks about how Ford, although Ford isn't even a Christian, polices the morality of his workers. Like, he only wants to employ family men. He doesn't want to employ single men. And the idea is that the worker, indeed, is doing this highly energetic kind of work, you know, and so which forces them to almost become a machine, and to become a machine successfully, they have to be desexualized. So what's happening at the end of Fordism, at this moment in the late 60s, the moment of Sex Machine, is something quite different. It's you're becoming a machine, but you're becoming a quite different kind of machine. You're becoming a machine in the age of the computer, in the age of the sexy android. You're becoming a sex machine.
I was just also starting to think about, you know, Marcuse as well, who we, you know, is probably within this context, you know, we should kind of mention as well, of the Sex Machine, because it's Marcuse who was kind of arguing, again, this scenario you'll know more about than me, but it's the way that, you know, industrialization kind of, and the progress that was identified with industrialization seemed to lead to what I think he called an intensified unfreedom. And that it was the idea of pleasure would eventually come to succeed a world that is organized around work, when work itself becomes more mechanized and less dependent on human labor. And Marcuse became, you know, I think, right, published Eros and Civilization in 1955. So in the heart of the heart of this kind of quite conservative moment, but he's beginning to foresee how, you know, a post-industrial moment, if I can call, maybe that's an incorrect use of that term, but anyway, how a radical future would depend on kind of the displacement of kind of industrial work for other forms of work, which weren't around capital and profit, but actually around stuff that was more personally fulfilling and more pleasurable. And indeed, this is kind of where, you know, the beginnings of DJ culture start to come in. It's people, you know, people pursuing passions that are not obviously going to kind of earn them much of a living, but the by pursuing these new forms of labor and work practices through desire and through wanting, you know, to explore different forms of expression, including collective expression, the new forms of work come through, and these turn out to be new forms of quite flexible, creative work that are also quite precarious, but this is something that lies, you know, indeed, to repeat, lies at the heart of the emergence of DJ culture in the very beginning of the 1970s, as we see it, at least. Should we listen to some music? James Brown's Sex Machine, I suggest.
Yeah! Sex Machine!
Get up, get on up, get up now. Stay on the scene, get on up, like a loving machine, get on up, get up, get on up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a loving machine.
Yeah, Sex Machine. I mean, Herbert Marcuse, as you said, Tim, the German but American-based like philosopher who became a sort of hero to sections of the counterculture. Yeah, in the 50s, he writes Eros and Civilization, and he's talking about the ways in which capitalism kind of works through the repression of sexuality. And not long after that, he publishes this book, One Dimensional Man, in which he says that consumer capitalism is increasingly actually allowing people to sort of be unrepressed, but in an oppressive way. So basically, you're encouraged just to express yourself through buying stuff and to express your freedom, indeed, through things like driving a car, instead of having what he would see as more authentic freedom. And then, of course, by the end of the 60s, the problem, the question for the counterculture, and the question, a key question of politics and culture in the 70s becomes, well, can you escape the limits of Fordism without just becoming even more of a slave of capitalism? Can you do it? And some people will be trying, and some people will say you can't, and some people aren't interested. But that's the problem which the breakdown of Fordism poses, and that's what I think we'll get into, part of what we'll get into next time.
Excellent. Look forward to that. Have a good week.
Yeah.